meeting is now being recorded.
All right. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Subteam Track 3 String Contention Objections and Disputes call held on the 15th of August, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Thank you. Hearing no names, I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking. For recording purposes, to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. And with this, I'll turn it over to our co-chair, Robin Gross. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to everyone who's joined the call today. We will continue to go through the objections here in Work Team 3. If anyone would like to take this opportunity to update their statement of interest, this would be a good time to do that. So just let us know now. All right, not seeing any hands or hearing any voices on that. Let's get into the meat of our agenda. A plenary update. Let's see. I don't think we've got either of the two plenary co-chairs on the call today, Avery, Doria, or Jeff Newman. So is there a member of ICANN staff, perhaps, who could pick up this agenda item and update us on activity at the plenary level very briefly? I see Steve's got his hand up. Please, Steve, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. This is Steve Chan from staff, and sure, in Jeff and Aubrey's absence, I'd be happy to provide a brief update. So the full working group plenary, they met on the 7th of August. They discussed two of the topics relevant to the drafting teams. One is the application submission method, whether it be rounds or first come, first serve, or whatever the methodology might be. The other topic that was discussed was the predictability framework. There's been good conversation on the list the last couple of days about the intersection with the framework that this working group is working on and its how it interplays with the consensus policy implementation framework. So both of those two drafting teams, plus another one on application types, have their own dedicated mailing list. They have they welcome new members and welcome conversations. So if there's anyone on this list that would like to participate, definitely just let staff know. We'd be happy to add you. The other topic that the full work group discussed briefly was the work of Work Track 5. That's dedicated to geographic names at the top level. I believe Jeff had mentioned that outreach had been done to try to solicit volunteers for leaders from each of the ALAC, the GAC, the CCNSO, and the GNSO. We're still in the process of collecting nominees or volunteers for that leadership team. So that's about the level of progress that's been made on Work Track 5. The next full working group meeting is actually the 29th of August at 0300. We're actually skipping next week, I believe, due to continued absences from Aubrey and Jeff. So I think that's it. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks very much, Steve. Does anyone have any questions for Steve on this? I do, actually, just quickly. On Work Track 5, the geographic names, is there a deadline by which names should be tested or submitted if they'd like to be considered for the leadership team on this? What kind of time frame do we have for this? Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Robin. This is Steve again. The communication that was sent by Jeff and Aubrey suggested that nominees be put forth by the 18th of August. As of this time, we have not received any of the nominees yet. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. Any other questions for Steve? All Okay, well, I don't see any hands or hear any voices, so let's continue in our agenda. And the next item will be a couple of follow-up items from the last Work Team 3 discussion. And the first has to do with a comment that the registry stakeholder group put forward regarding gaming of objections and possibly getting two bites at the apple when it comes to the CPE and filing objections. And there was some uncertainty on the call last time as to what exactly that comment was getting at. And so there was some thought that perhaps someone from the registry stakeholder group could participate on this call and just give us a little more background about what that comment was about and what that recommendation ultimately entails. So, John Nevitt, I understand you've been tasked with being that registry representative. So if you would like to just give us a little bit more background about what that particular comment was about, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. You can hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone. So the comment, the genesis of the comment was at the community objection process and looking at the community priority evaluation process. And there were some instances in this past round where instead of the paradigm, which was a community gets together and applies for a TLD, and they go through a CPE. And if they go through the CPE, it knocks everyone out, everyone else who applied for that string. So, for example, if the Apache Nation got together and applied for .apache, and they got CPE, anyone else who applied for .apache would be knocked out. The other process was, let's say .apache, the Apache Nation didn't apply for .apache, but someone else did. And the Apache Nation wanted to object to that use of that string, they have the process to go for an objection and say they don't this applicant doesn't represent the Apache Nation, and go through the different requirements of the objection process. And if they win, then those other applicants get knocked out. So there are two ways to knock out applicants. So when we came up with the rules in the last policy process, I don't believe that folks thought that the same party would do both processes. It was one or the other. It was either you apply and you knock everyone out if you get community through the CPE process, or you don't apply and you go through an objection process. And there were some examples in this round where some folks tried to use both processes, and the problem with that is you could have inconsistent results, and it's just more process. So the registry folks that got together said, well, let's say if you're an applicant, be an applicant and go through CPE and knock people out that way, and if you're not an applicant, be an objector and knock people out that way. And so that was the two bites of the apple. So you'd, instead of creating a scenario where you have more process and the ability for inconsistent results, the recommendation was, let's just pick one so you don't have the same party. Now, if there's a party that applied as a community for a string, and a different part of that community or other people still want to object, that's perfectly fine. But the problem that we found was when it was the exact same people, the exact same lawyers and the exact same litigants going after both processes, and we thought that was not appropriate. So that's the background and history. Any questions or input on that recommendation that I can answer? I'm happy to answer.
Great. Thanks very much for that, John. That is very helpful. I see we've got a hand raised here. Jamie Baxter, please go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Jamie Baxter for the record. I do have a question about the process. It's a little bit unclear as to who has the right to do what if the applicant themselves were to have to choose one or the other. It's a little bit unclear as to whether the standard applicants are still required to respond to any objections that come in. If the community applicant is expected to respond to any objections that come in, or exactly how the process works. So if you could maybe expand on your thinking around that a little bit more,
sure.
That would be appreciated.
Sorry, James. Oh, you're done. Thanks for the question. I think the thinking is, if you are an applicant, if you are a community applicant, you go through the CPE track, you do not object to the others. You win if you get CPE. If you're not a community applicant and you think you represent a community, then you're free to object. So then you go down the objection path. It's when you try to go down both paths, you know, an example, maybe Dot Music, for example, you could look up. They tried to go down every path. And so the thinking is, if you're a community objection, you go down the CPE path. If you're not, if you're a community applicant, you go down the CPE path. If you're a member of a community and want to object to one or all the applicants, you're free to do that at any time going down the objection path. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sorry, I'll jump in. Jamie Baxter again. I appreciate that. That's helpful. There's one thing that I think is important for us to pull back to, though, and that is the purpose of these processes. What seems to be forgotten is that the objection phase is to eliminate harm. And I think it's important to note that given the first experience we had, community priority evaluation, that it didn't always work out. And so by simply selecting community priority evaluation, it doesn't guarantee that the community is going to achieve community status. Whereas the objection phase exists to eliminate harm towards that community. So I don't see a path where you can force the applicant to choose between the two. I think I understand what you're saying about the community applicant itself not being able to apply. However, the community organizations shouldn't have any power taken away from them to be able to object if they see the need to eliminate harm, because an unsuccessful CPE means that a harmful application could potentially win at auction. So I just don't want us to lose the fact that the community objection process exists to eliminate harm.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. We also had comments about one of the problems with community was that it was an all or nothing endeavor. And there was no ability to eliminate or minimize or mitigate harm in the current process. For example, if there was a proposal for a restricted registry, for example, and that would have eliminated the concern of the community, there was no way to do that, right? If there's an objection result that came out and said, hey, we think your standard, quote-unquote, standard TLD would be harmful to the community, there was no way for them to say, unless you add the following criteria or registration requirements or whatnot. It was all or nothing, do or die, and I think that was why there was so much fighting back and forth, because there was no way to make an accommodation. It was very difficult to make an accommodation after the fact. You try to think about it beforehand and try to do it, but it was hard to do it after the fact. So, that was one of our other comments that we put in there. But the comment that we're making about two bites of the apple was limited to the exact applicant itself. But the applicant should go down one path, and if the community still thinks that the other folks would create harm to your point, then they're free to file an objection.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate that. We've next got Paul McGrady in the queue. Paul, please.
Thank you, Paul McGrady. So I guess this is a question for John, since he seems the most knowledgeable. But are the two elements of the two different paths exactly the same?
No, there was that 14-point scale on the CPE, and then it's very comparable, but not, no, they're not exactly the same.
So it's two bites of two different flavors of apple, but not two bites of the same apple.
Yeah, exactly, and that's why it makes it even more likely to have an inconsistent result.
Thanks.
Okay. Any point? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Anyone else want to get in the queue on this issue?
This is a question from Phil Buckingham.
Oh.
And I'm just trying to.
I see. Yes. Thank you.
Forewarning that an applicant will apply for CPE. I'm not sure if he means before the deadline or after the deadline. I suspect no one would be comfortable with saying that before the deadline that you have to announce that you're applying the CPE when someone else could come in. I assume no one would like that. But after the deadline, when it gets announced, sure, that makes sense to me.
Great, thanks. Anyone else have any comments or questions on this issue, two bites at the apple, CPE and objections? All right, I don't see any hands or questions. So thank you very much, John, for your input on this. Let's go on to the next agenda item, another review from last week or follow-up from last week, and that's just on the issue of the independent objector issue. And we've had a chance to take a look at the summary of the report that was the independent objector's final activity report, and it's got some interesting observations and recommendations that I thought we should go through some of them and see how it fits in with our earlier discussions or what at least what we think we ought to do going forward on independent objector. There was, let's just sort of dive into the report, or to, at least to the summary, and some of the very specific issues and recommendations that were raised. And one of them I thought was very interesting. The summary discussed the independent objector's interpretation of the framework for objecting on the limited public interest grounds. And the objector concluded with the recommendation that only the fourth ground should be retained in a future version of the AGP. And so the fourth ground is a determination that an applied for GTLD string would be contrary to specific principles of international law as reflected in relevant international instruments of law. So it sounds like this was a pretty clear recommendation about narrowing the limited public interest objection. Let me just put this, let me put that exact language there in the chat as to what the fourth ground is that he suggests we retain, and that the determination that the applied for GTLD string would be contrary to specific principles of international law as reflected in relevant international instruments of law. So, does anyone have any thoughts on this particular recommendation or this particular issue? I see Christina has got a question in the chat. Staff, can you post the LPIO grounds in the chat so we can see the three that the IO recommends be rejected? Yes, that would be very helpful. Okay, well, I don't see any comments on this, and so while we wait for that particular piece of information, what these other three grounds are, let's go on to some of the other recommendations that were made by the independent objector. And so there are actually 10 pretty specific ones at the end of the report, so if you want to sort of scroll down to the end. Oh. I'm sorry, I see a hand up. Anne, please come in.
Yes, thanks, Robin. I'm sorry I had to come in late to the meeting, but I just was curious about the recommendation on eliminating grounds for a limited public interest objection. What I'm trying to raise, and this is just a question, I know that one of the specific limited public interest objections that was mentioned in the AGB was a human rights objection to an application, but I had a recollection it was maybe it was a subset of this fourth ground. I'm just trying to remember where that human rights reference appeared, since we do now have a new human rights core value that's been adopted in connection with accountability. So what ground did human rights appear under? Was it the fourth ground or some other ground?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think you're right. I think it was the fourth ground, but let's get confirmation of that, since we were talking about, we cited some human rights treaties in the AGB. But I see John's got his hand up and Paul's got his hand up, so let's go to the queue on this. Please, John, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. So I'm just looking at the four grounds. One was incitement to or promotion of violent, lawless action. Two was incitement to or promotion of discrimination based upon race, color, gender, ethnicity, religion, or national origin, or other similar types of discrimination that violate generally accepted legal norms recognized under principles of international law. And three was incitement to or promotion of child pornography or other sexual abuse of children. And then or four is the fourth one that you have listed there. I guess the second one is probably the human rights one that you're referring to. Oh, yeah, and Emily put it in.
That's really interesting, because it seems to me sort of like the first three grounds are sort of all subsets of number four, but that's just, kind of my reading of it here. I'd be curious what other people think. Please, Paul, come in.
Thanks. Robin, this is Paul McGrady for the record. Robin, I don't know if this is the right time to ask this question, but maybe we can figure out when in this conversation it would be. But on our last call, I asked whether or not we would be able to determine how much money had been spent on the independent objector. I can't see that anywhere in this document. Is staff still digging for that? Were they able to get a hold of that information? Because I do think it's important to compare his success rate with how many dollars were spent on him to see whether or not it's an efficient use. I know that some people on the last call didn't think efficiency should be the lens we should look at him through, but I do think it's an important lens. Any progress on finding those dollars?
Good question, Paul. I haven't seen that data myself, but I think you're right that it's an important piece of information to this overall analysis. People can, choose to weigh it as highly or not highly as they want, but I think, we do want to get that information. So if there's somebody from staff who can jump in and tell us where they are on that, that would be really helpful. Okay, and let me go on in the queue. I see Ann, please. Come ahead.
Thanks, Robin. It's Ann for the transcript. To Paul's point, which I think is, it's a very good point about, return on investment, but my personal view is it shouldn't really be a question of independent objector or no independent objector, because I don't know who has standing to lodge a limited public interest objection. I think there has to be some additional gate on the decisions about independent objection that is just supposed to, again, be based on the public interest. And I tend to feel that it's really the board of ICAM that in many ways is the guardian of the public interest. And I feel as though there should be a potentially a non-conflicted subset of people from the board that, you know, at least have some kind of input on how many of these things get filed and for what reasons. So I just think that the issue on funds and funds that get spent, there just needs to be an additional gatekeeper on that, whatever the community thinks is appropriate, because I know the statistics were not particularly good. And it probably shouldn't just be one individual determining what the public interest is. Of course, that's an ongoing dialogue that we have. The second point I wanted to make was really to agree with your observation earlier that the three grounds that are listed that someone was kind enough to read out, I feel that if there's a recommendation to eliminate those and rest only on the fourth ground, that one would still provide those three grounds as examples of things that may or may not fall within the parameters of the fourth ground. I mean, I think the examples themselves are very much worth mentioning in terms of, again, how we look at the public interest and how we define public interest. And so I would like to, if there's some kind of groundswell, hey, let's eliminate everything but the fourth ground, I still think that those are valuable examples that fit underneath the fourth ground. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ann. John, please go ahead.
Thanks, and sorry to over-participate in this call, but, you know, we lived this stuff for a while. One of the limited public interest issues that we had was we went through independent objector objections we got, but the one that we lost in the objection was on Dot Hospital on limited public interest grounds. And if you read those four qualifications, you would be scratching your head as well of why a Dot Hospital would be violation of international law. And we went through an appeal process, a reconsideration. Actually, the ICANN board shockingly agreed to reconsider it, and it finally went through. But the IO took an interesting position that it was not the name itself or even the use in the application, but could someone potentially use a name that violates one of these things? And that's based on that standard, you know, a lot of TLDs would have an issue. So if we're looking at changing the standard or clarifying it, I think we might want to look at the materials from Dot Hospital and the board overruling of the IO complaint and saying, no, when we talked about limited public interest, we really meant the string itself or the intended use of the TLD by the registry. And not, you know, potential use by third-party registrants. And, you know, Robin will remember in the last round when we were drafting these rules that, you know, we always talked about .Nazi and, you know, is that appropriate? Is that a violation of law based on the name? It depends who's applying for it. Is it a Simon Wiesenthal Center or is it, you know, folks who are hanging out in Charlottesville this weekend? And you know, so those are the kinds of issues this group might want to take another look at and clarify the rules so that an over aggressive IO doesn't get swept into doing something like the last one did. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, John. And actually, that couldn't have been a more perfect segue into the first three recommendations that the IO made. So if folks want to look at those in particular, because they're really right on point here, the first one is about need to clarify definitions of key terms in the applicant guidebook. And by way of example, they talk about understanding what they mean by the limited public interest objection. And the second recommendation talks about a need for clarification with respect to the community objections and more precise definitions. And again, I know this is something that we've said, it seems to be now a number of times in the course of our discussions here. And then the third recommendation in particular, to John's point, I think, was a request for clarification that the AGP should explicitly mention that the expert panel will conduct the analysis on the basis of the applied for GTLD string itself and its intended purpose as stated and described in the application. So I think that, you know, we're kind of right, seem to be coming to some kinds of consensus on a number of these things. Did anyone else want to say anything in particular about maybe these first three recommendations and calls for clarification in some of the definitions and the purpose of the application? Does anyone else want to get in on this? Okay, well, I don't see or hear anyone. So let's sort of go on to the fourth recommendation, which has to deal with highly objectionable applications, and again, asks for a specific definition with respect to highly objectionable. And he asks that it should be explicitly stated in the AGB that the independent objector has discretionary power in deciding if an application is highly objectionable or not, even if it must also be clear that the independent objector will have to explain its choices. So this, I thought, was kind of an important point because it talks about giving the independent objector discretionary power on deciding if a application is objectionable. And so I wanted to see what people thought about this recommendation. Christina, please go ahead.
Thanks. Christina Rosette, Amazon. I disagree fairly strongly with this recommendation. I think part of the reason the applicants who had such an abysmal experience with the independent objector process did in fact have such an abysmal experience is that there was actually already too much discretion afforded to the independent objector. And I think keeping with what I think we've reached kind of an informal consensus on, and certainly going back to the original policy principles and recommendations, that we want certainty and predictability, I cannot support a recommendation that we give the IO more discretion. I do think, however, that there should be clearer guidelines as to what does and does not constitute a highly objectionable application.
Great. Thank you very much. That's very clear. Did anyone else want to weigh in on this? Okay, I don't see any hands. And actually, the next recommendation, number five, is sort of along the same lines in that it is, again, the independent objector recommending that he be explicitly granted access to other objections within a reasonable time under this concept of extraordinary circumstances. So it seems to be another, similar to the last recommendation, it says here, he wants the IO to be granted a, sorry, my page numbers got a little out of whack there. Okay. The AGB should follow its reasoning through and develop the concept of extraordinary circumstances and explicitly grant the independent objector access to other types of objections within reasonable time prior to making the decision to withdraw his own objection. So I wanted to see what others thought about that. The independent objector seems to think he is limited in filing objections where no objection has been filed against the same string on the same ground and where there is no extraordinary circumstances. So did anyone want to weigh in on this one? Yes, Christina, please go ahead.
Christina Rosette, Amazon again. I also disagree with And I should note that the limitation on final aid objections were no objection. What's in the first sentence of recommendation, his recommendation 5, is an accurate summary of what's in the guidebook. However, it was my experience that the IO took the position that it was an extraordinary, or it could be an extraordinary circumstance if another objection had been filed against the same string on the same grounds, but it was of such poor quality that the other objector would fail. And frankly, I think that defeats the spirit and the purpose of having the IO be the objector of last resort. So I would recommend strongly against taking the position that the IO can have access to the other objections to see whether or not they have merit before making a determination as to whether he would file. And as a corollary to that, I would also disagree with the recommendation that the IO should get an additional period of 2 months after the publication of the list of objections, because then you are potentially putting an applicant in a position of at a minimum doubling the length of time that they're going to spend in the objection process. And there's really no fact-based justification for that at this point.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else want to weigh in on recommendation 6? I'm sorry, 5. Apologies, 5. Okay. So let's go on to number 6 then. And that one has to do with initial notice procedure, which the independent objector has created. He says that ICANN encourages applicants and objectors to enter into mediation or negotiation prior to or during the objection process, and such alternatives do not always correspond to the IO's mission. He has created this initial notice procedure, which took place before the objection proceedings, and this, he says, this procedure was a success welcomed by all applicants and therefore suggests that ICANN should formalize this new procedure in the AGP. So how do folks think about this recommendation? Anyone have any experience with this process? Okay, I see we've got a couple hands up here. Jamie and then Christina. Please, go ahead.
Yes, Jamie Baxter for the record. I think what's interesting is that the community applicants seem to be left out of this opportunity because there is no ability to change the applications, even if the effort is towards mitigating risk or eliminating harm or overcoming any challenges that may be brought through the objection process. So it's an interesting thing for community applicants when you look at them in the larger picture.
Thanks very much, Jamie. Christina, please go ahead.
Thanks very much. I am currently agnostic as to whether or not the initial notice process or something like that should be formalized in the AGB. However, what I am not agnostic on is that if it is, there must be very clearly specified and delineated criteria under which the IO can use it and under which the IO must make a determination that there will be no objection. I went through this process with an applicant that I was representing. There was no clear criteria by which you could, if you looked at the universe of applications for which the IO had used this initial notice procedure and tried to figure out what the criteria were in terms of when the application was then subject to an objection and when it wasn't, there was no consistency there at all. So I would say that if we are going to take this on, that we can't leave it up to his discretion.
Thank you, Christina. Paul McGrady, please come in.
Hi, Paul McGrady. So I just would like to register a yikes on this one, that if he thinks it's such a nature that it should be part of the next applicant guidebook, then I do wonder whether or not he should have been up to it in the first place. You know, if it's significant enough it seems to me that he should have followed what the guidebook said instead of making up his own process. That doesn't really address the question of whether or not we should take it on as a, you know, might have been on its own independently a good idea, but I do think it's an example of how much discretion this particular independent objector thought he had that I don't think we gave him as a community. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Anyone else want to get in the queue and weigh in on the recommendation number six on the initial notice procedure? Okay, so let's go on to option seven, which has to do with the independence and integrity and conflicts of interest in the, with respect to the independent objector office. So he says that he suggests that ICANN should envisage in, to expressly state in the rule applicable in the future that if the independence and integrity of the IO is challenged, the issue should be decided by the expert panel in the case in which it is raised. Moreover, the public posting on ICANN's website of a declaration of independence and impartiality by the IO should be envisaged. Also, ICANN should reflect on the possibility to provide for the appointment of an alternate IO. Another solution would be the establishment of a list of substitutes to the IO or the expert panel could refer to in case they deem it necessary. Okay, so are there any thoughts about this recommendation number seven and how to handle claims of conflict of interest and in independence and integrity of the IO office itself? Okay, Christina, please go ahead.
I really do not want this to be the Christina show, so I would love to hear from other applicants who have a view on this. But having said that, a couple points. First, the IO's Declaration of Independence and Impartiality was, in fact, posted, so I'm not really quite sure what that part of the recommendation adds. Neutral on having kind of a pool of IOs as opposed to, you know, having to be an office rather than a person. What I'm not neutral on is the idea that the applicant would have to go through the entire process of having to prepare a full response to the objection before the conflict of interest is determined. I do think it needs to be delineated who has the authority and obligation to address conflicts of interest. That was very murky, and if you were an applicant that was unfortunate enough to end up in this situation, you ended up in a bizarre twilight zone where ICANN said that they couldn't be involved because that the independent objector was independent, and so if they were involved at all in applying the ICANN conflict of interest rules, then there would no longer be any independence. But there was nothing in the guidebook that actually required the expert panel to consider conflicts of interest. What I would like us to go ahead and propose instead is that in the event that the applicant has believes that there is a conflict of interest, and I think there's some authority in terms of processes and procedures that we can look to in terms of here are the criteria that would constitute a conflict of interest. If they can meet those criteria, at least as kind of a showing on the face, then there should be a separate process that deals solely with the conflict of interest. And only if it's determined that that there is no conflict of interest would the applicant then have the obligation to prepare and submit a full response to the objection along with whatever the fee is. And for the purpose of the applicant raising a conflict of interest, I think there should also be consideration that in the event that the IO is found to have had a conflict of interest, that there should be some reimbursement to the applicant of the dispute resolution provider fee that they've spent up to that point.
Great. Thank you very much. Did anyone else want to weigh in on recommendation number seven and how to handle conflicts of interest? Anne, yes, please, go ahead.
Hi, it's Anne for the transcript. It just seems like it's another gatekeeping issue on the question of conflict of interest, that actually a conflict of interest, you know, just it, I guess I agree with it. It should be determined very early on as to who determines whether or not there's a conflict of interest. I don't know whether you have some sort of separate standing panel or whether the same committee I propose as a subcommittee of the board could determine that. But in terms of just trying to save a lot of, you know, wasted resources, if there's an alleged conflict of interest, it should work the same way it works when, you know, we challenge a judge in the existing U.S. legal system. You know, hopefully when there's a conflict of interest, the individual recuses himself or herself, but if not, it's got to come as an initial determination, and I agree with that. But how, you know, who makes the determination is, you know, we need a mechanism for it. And I would go back to the idea that it's appropriate for a non-conflicted subset of the board to be involved in these independent limited public interest objections. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anne. Anybody else want to weigh in on recommendation 7? Yes, Susan, please, go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in any of these, so I'm not speaking from a level of experience, but wouldn't there also be an opportunity or a possibility that the dispute resolution provider themselves could make a kind of preliminary determination on a conflict issue, you know, before everyone has gone through the whole process of kind of pleading and arguing and having the case on the merits heard? I mean, that seems to me to be a way that one would handle it in court. Certainly in my jurisdiction, that would be how things, you know, if you felt that the judge or an arbitrator or whatever was in a conflict position, you know, it would be dealt with within those proceedings as a preliminary matter. As I say, I didn't handle any of these cases, so I don't know if there's a reason why that wouldn't work here or why that would make it extremely, you know, costly for the parties or something. But it, you know, given that ICANN is so keen to not be on the hook for any liability on anything, is that a way forward?
Thanks very much, Susan. I suspect Paul has the answer for us here. Paul, please go ahead.
Paul McGrady. Yeah, I wish I had the answer, Susan. But I do think that this is an area that's significantly broken, and that we need to look at this particular recommendation, not for the recommendation itself, which is written in a way that sort of makes it more confusing rather than what it should be, which is pretty straightforward, and spell out where the breakdowns are. So, for example, in his report, the independent objector says, you know, the conflict of interest document said I shouldn't be representing any new GTLD applicant, but, you know, gee whiz, some governments that were interested in the Patagonia application, you know, I used to represent those guys, but that's not really a conflict. Well, it seems to me that when you're looking at conflicts of interest, you can't just look at whether or not you're representing a new GTL applicant. You actually sort of have to, you know, look at the entire picture. And it seemed like he was applying a very legalistic standard where he met the requirements set forth in the guidebook or whatever, or wherever the requirements were set forth, but he wasn't looking at the greater picture, which is there any potential to be viewed as being in a conflict? And he goes on to say that the independent objector isn't a judge or a neutral, but yet in some respects they have to be a judge or a neutral if they are balancing the public interest for the entire community. They can't just, you know, act for one point of view without balancing all those other point of views before they file a complaint. And so not only I think it was the standard flawed, but I think that the way that he tried to explain what happened in his own report just sends up big red flags that this is an area that we need to fix, because we, you know, we want to have independent objector or objectors, if we end up deciding we still need them, by the way, who are able to take a much more nuanced view of this rather than just saying, okay, there's one little box here that ICANN gave me to check off, and I'm not squarely within that little box, so I'm okay. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Paul. Anybody else want to weigh in on number seven, recommendation seven? Okay, not seeing any hands. Let's. Oh, there is a hand. Uh-huh. Anne, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Robin. It's Anne for the transcript. Some of this discussion leads me to think that there could be an alternative as far as independent objectors, that they would work more like mediators or arbitrators, where there would be a group of individuals who, you know, potentially in each particular case, that individual could be asked to undertake an independent objector role on just a one-time contract basis, rather than, you know, vesting all of this into one individual. And that might also address some of the budget concerns. But then again, you do need a way to qualify those people, and a way to, but not to look at the person as staff, but, and I don't know whether that would lead to inconsistent results and be considered bad by the community, but it's just an idea that an IO could be more like a group of a pre-approved IOs. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's move on to recommendation number eight then, which is actually one of the most, I think, one of the more important recommendations that is made here in terms of us thinking about and talking about. And recommendation eight says, it is certainly appropriate to reflect on possible appeals following a determination upon an IO's objection, but the reconsideration process as it exists is clearly not a suitable option. And earlier in this paper, the IO reflects on the fact that the new GTLD dispute resolution procedure makes no specific provisions for an appeal process and expresses disappointment that some applicants use the reconsideration request process as a substitute for an appeals process. The IO concludes that he is not ideologically opposed to an appeal process in the framework of the ICANN new GTLD dispute resolution procedure, but believes that the process should be expressly provided by the AGB and held before arbitrators who have the last say. So this is, you know, actually an important recommendation, because it's talking about what kind of appeals process do we want to have here, and who makes the final decision. Is it the board, or is it the independent, the expert panels? And, you know, I think that, and as John says, and who could appeal? That's a good question. So I think that this particular recommendation is actually something that we should spend a bit of time on thinking about, is the reconsideration request process appropriate for this? Do we need an entirely separate and unique to GTLD's appeals mechanisms? And is this a decision that should be made by the board or by the expert panel? And frankly, I think there's even a question as to the extent to which it could be made by the expert panel if it has, you know, if it touches upon things that have to do with the board's fiduciary responsibilities. So I think this, you know, this particular recommendation is rather meaty and worthy of considerable discussion. And we've got 4 minutes left in this meeting. Okay, so would anyone like to weigh in on this particular recommendation, number eight, the appeals process, what sort of appeals process we should have, and how is the reconsideration request process working out in your mind for handling that? Anybody have any thoughts? Okay, Susan, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Susan Payne. I'm not going to get into a whole level of detail on this one, I think, but I mean, just to point out that, I mean, obviously the independent objector is talking about it being appropriate to have an appeal in relation to independent objector proceedings, but this is, as you've been saying, this is a really weighty topic, and the notion of whether there should be appeals is most certainly not limited to just the objections by the independent objector. And indeed, given the lack of success of most of the independent objector proceedings, they seem to be, one might argue, they're the least requiring of an appeals process. But I think it's a really important point that we should be discussing, and I think generally people do feel that the reconsideration request and the IRP process has had to be sort of kind of twisted, if you like, in order to make it applicable in circumstances where really if there'd been an appeals process in the first place, it would have been much more suitable for everyone.
Great. Thank you very much, Susan. I see Steve has his hand up. Please, Steve, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. This is Steve from staff, and I was actually just going to try to draw the sort of similar distinction that Susan just made and point out that a lot of the recommendations from the IO seem to strike me as more broad than just directly related to the IO. So he had several recommendations regarding limited public interest objections and then also the community objections, and then, as Susan just mentioned, the appeals process. So, like I said, I just wanted to make sure and try to draw that distinction that some of his recommendations are specific to the role of the IO, and then some are more general that might be worthy of consideration for those more specific topics. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. And I would also add to that list the recommendation about clarification of definitions. It isn't something that is only with respect to the IO. It's something that we've seen throughout this whole process that we need more of, and so this is just kind of another example. Right up at the top of the hour right now, and I feel like we've just sort of started this discussion, and I see in the chat Paul McGrady's asked if we could put this issue back up to the top of our list for the next call, more than 4 minutes. I agree. So I would recommend that we do that. And I see Christina's asked, has the board taken any action on the IO's report, specifically referred it to the GNSO or something else? Steve, please, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. This is Steve from staff, and I think I raised my hand at an inopportune time because I don't know the answer to the question you just mentioned. But what I actually just wanted to raise real quickly is that there's, at least from a staff perspective, there seems to be at least three elements to this discussion about the IO. I'm sure there's maybe more than that, but the first is maybe the principle of whether or not it makes sense for there to be something like an independent objector. Then second is, whether the rules, the framework, and then the implementation are appropriate or correct. And then lastly is the execution, which it seems like a fair amount of the conversation today was about the execution of this particular independent objector. And so, for instance, that seems to maybe play into the dollar figures question. So maybe this particular IO did not execute as well as the work track would expect or would like to see. So I just raised that to maybe, so there's all these different facets that the work track could consider looking at. I'm not sure which is the right thing to look at, but I just wanted to maybe draw that distinction and have the work track try to figure out where they like to draw their attention to. Maybe it's all three. Maybe it's one at a time or whatever is appropriate. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. That's a really good point. And it actually reminded me of something else. I know last week the work track talked about possibly inviting in the independent objector to, discuss some of these issues with him and using that as a means to try to get a better understanding of the issues. And we did think we needed to go through this summary report first and do a little bit of homework on what was recommended before we considered that further. But I wonder what folks think now about, is that something that we would want to do, to invite the independent objector in for a meeting and ask questions, or are folks pretty much satisfied with what you've learned from, you know, the reading his report? And I know we're 2 minutes over the hour, so I promise I'll stop now. I just wanted to ask that question and if anyone had any quick thoughts on that. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up to a close, and we'll pick up with this same issue next time. And thank you all for very good discussion today and your participation. And our next meeting will take place on the 29th of August at 1500 UTC. Thank you very much. Oh, I see Susan has her hand up. Please, Susan, go ahead.
Sorry, no, actually I don't. It's just incompetence. I can't work out how to get it to come down.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Robin. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Today's meeting is adjourned. You can disconnect all lines and have a fantastic day.